Well, you can tell from the introductions that this is an extremely diverse group, ranging from people who study rats to people who educate humans and everything in between. So we really need to organize, self-organize. I should say that we do not have a hidden agenda here. In fact, we have no agenda, as far as I could tell, which we want to self-organize. So over the next 5 or 10 minutes, while we do have one item to tell you about, I want you to think about issues or items that you'd like to bring up, and we're going to get a straw poll and then decide what it is that we're going to do for the rest of the meeting, the breakout session. The one thing, though, that is on the agenda is a town hall meeting that has been organized. It will take place in San Diego on March 3rd, and I want Paul Talal to tell you a little bit about what we're planning to do with Roger Bingham. The title of this meeting, it was meant to be a town hall meeting. It was in the original proposal, and the idea was to bring together educators, researchers, school administrators, business people who are all interested in the issue of education. And after discussing it, we realized that science of learning is really a little bit narrow because it focuses so much on the learner. And the science of teaching is also very narrow because it focuses on the teacher. And so instead of thinking about it from these two perspectives, we decided to call it the science of educating. Education is a two-way road. It requires a learner and a teacher interacting together. And so that's going to be the focus for the town hall meeting. I'm going to let Paula and Roger tell you about how it's going to be organized.
Well, first of all, we hope that you all will really take seriously our invitation for everyone to come and to invite others. This is a very much an open meeting. Roger Bingham and the Science Network has really become specialized in doing these town hall meetings, which bring together scientists with other interested parties and perspectives on topics of great social relevance. So they've done, I'm sure Roger will tell you some of the ones that they've done, but the real issue is to create a dialogue between people with lots of different perspectives on topics of great social relevance, and clearly the science of educating is a tremendous social relevance at so many different levels with so many different stakeholders and participants and whatever. Now, there have been, interestingly, in the last couple of years, a number of conferences that have been organized on the on the interface between neuroscience and education. And if you look at those programs, basically it's a group of neuroscientists who are getting together and talking to, or as you might want to say less generously, at educators. And that is not the goal of this meeting. We are interested in having as many or even more heavy hitters amongst the individuals who are the stars of their field in the areas of education from lots of different levels, from the federal level, the state level, the superintendent and administrator level, school level, and parents, students, or whatever. So our goal has been to really, really try to find the right people for this meeting. And we know the scientists really well. It would have been really easy to just put this together amongst a bunch of scientists who always talk to each other, because there's only a handful of us that really do focus our work on science, of integrating neuroscience into education. But that wasn't our goal. So this meeting hopefully will be quite different and look quite different. And the real goal, if we're successful, is that it's a dialogue, it's a two-way street. As Terry said, that's why we called it the science of educating. Starting at the very beginning, thinking in terms of a two-way street between the brain of the child and the teacher. You can think of lots of different issues, input and output. You can think of nature and nurture. I mean, there's all sorts of different reasons why you would want to focus this somewhat differently on science of educating rather than the science of learning or the science of teaching. So that's the goal. We're very fortunate that we had the opportunity, together with our corporate partner, Scientific Learning Corporation, we had already been asked and had agreed to put on a small program for the CCSSO, which is the Council of Chief State School Officers. And these are the individuals from each state in the United States who have the primary responsibility in their state for what goes on in schools at the state level. And so we had started to work on that program, and they have an initiative that they've put together with Scientific Learning Corporation, which is focused on neuroscience and education. So they did the first one at UCSF, and they did the second one at Rutgers Newark. April was involved in that one, and Ian Kreese, basically, who's the co-director there, gave an overview of the TDLC, etc. And we agreed to have the third one here, so that's all we were putting together. And then the feedback from CCSSO, apparently, had been, we loved the events, but we didn't feel like we had really been able to contribute back. And so this seems like a perfect time to also take our mandate to have a town hall, and we had already decided to have that town hall meeting on science and education at some level. So we said, let's make this a full-day event, take advantage of the CCSO group being with us already, and get their input as well as to who else to invite. So that's how we've been organizing this. And I think it's going to be really terrific. And Roger Bingham's going to tell us a little bit more about it from his perspective, as well as just what a town hall means, because I think most scientists don't really know, and it would help for you to say, a lot of people have asked me, how many people do you expect there and whatever, so maybe Roger can tell us a little bit about how the other ones that he's done have kind of organically come together.
Well, I actually don't think it's that difficult. You've probably seen them on CNN anyway. Right. the issue, what we've been doing at the Science Network, how many of you actually know what the Science Network is, have any clue? I mean, apart from the group that I was just with. All right, so we're on Web TV, we're based at the Salk Institute. We started with a launch event that was about stem cells in 2004, at the end of 2004. It was mostly, we had a series of panels there on the science, the ethics, the international implications, economic implications. In other words, taking the science in its societal context. And that's what the that's what each of these things that we do is. It's basically issues at the intersection of science and social policy. And we do conversations primarily. I also do one-on-one conversations with scientists as well. You can see those on the website. And I've got some little flyers here, which I'll leave around a little bit later on. We start with two quotes, I suppose. One is that Carl Sagan. Do you remember Carl Sagan? Anybody? Yes, good. He used to talk about he had a vision of science as being a candle in the dark. So in making these programs, we like to think that we're making more candles, more light, and that eventually that there'll be enough light to bring in us Enlightenment 2.0. The other quote is from Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who used to say that everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but not their own facts. So we spend some time making sure that the facts that we're putting out there are accurate. The format of the meeting is somewhat unusual in the sense that it's not a standard scientific meeting where people come in, give a 45-minute talk, and then go and have lunch and don't learn anything because they don't listen to everybody else's talk because they've heard it all before. So what we do is have very brief presentations, like somewhat like we've been doing here, and then the people actually have to interact with each other. I moderate a discussion. It just becomes a large conversation. And I think we'll get more out of it in the long run. We've been doing subjects, as I said, at the intersection of science and social policy. We have a number of ones coming up in the future, one called Hooked on the Science of Addiction. We'll be doing one on, we're already planning a Darwin Bicentennial. We did one last year called Beyond Belief, which attracted a lot of attention. It was about science and religion. And it actually gets a lot of traction. There was pieces in the New York Times. There were 3 million hits on the website, 500,000 downloads of 15 hours of conversation. So it gets a lot of attention. I'm trying to get to a point where we can get some more information about educating out there to a general public as well. So the idea is to bring together all of the, what's the word, stakeholders, participants in the whole education process. So there'll be people that Paul's already mentioned, scientists, people who work in the education business, teachers and parents into one room and find out if there's any what they can learn from each other. One of the things that I discovered very quickly in the session we just had, the small education outreach session, was that the teachers, the people at the sharp end, one of the suggestions that came out, and it might be one of your original things we want to talk about, Terry, is that there was a sense that the the bench scientists mostly don't get together enough with the specific mandate of figuring out how to translate their work. They stop at the rat or they stop at the slice. In Hal Pashler's case, obviously, it gets into the schoolroom, but there was a sense that perhaps everybody should get together and discuss specifically, or almost be mandated, in a sense, by our fearless leader, to come up with some translational activity and see how that would work in the classroom. So I would like to put that out for you as one thing to put on your list there. And
we call this InReach.
That's right.
Can I just mention one other thing that has been a driving force, I think, for me, is that I've been to several NSF and NIH panels, NIMH, whatever, panels over the last many years, where the goal was to try to understand better how to develop a plan for these organizations to fund research that has more potential for translation. And the one thing that was glaringly missing at every single one of them was any discussion whatsoever about the process through which translation research might most effectively occur. It always begins with, I think we should fund my idea, and it always ends with, I think we should fund my idea. That's just natural for scientists, and the problem has been there are always scientists in the room. When it really comes to the reality of translating research, which Bill and I and our company has had that opportunity, for better or worse, we realize it's really complicated, and there's such a different, there's so many different issues that have to be addressed that just never reach the level of cognition for scientists when we're discussing what kind of research we might want to do. So we might say, yes, we're really interested in doing research that has the potential to be translated. But then the issue of scaling up and what the actual process could be in making priorities about what we will or won't actually fund or do doesn't really seem to come up because we don't have a process. So if there was one thing that I would love to see ultimately this group begin to at least discuss is, what do we think as scientists the process should be? But then hear from the educators, and maybe even at this town hall meeting, I hope this might become a topic. What is it that superintendents take into consideration when they're making decisions to buy a program or implement? What is it that principals take in? What is it that teachers will decide to do? You know, how are these different? How are they the same? And how does that affect us as scientists in terms of what we think we're doing?
So I mentioned at the beginning that education is a two-way street, but in fact it's a two-way street embedded in a social context. And that social context has to do with the issues that Paula raised, which is that the principal may not be in the classroom, but the principal is making decisions which affects that classroom. And the superintendent is making bigger decisions that have even more impact, in fact, longer time scales. And so these people need to be in the same room because they need to hear what's happening too at the grassroots level. Paula raised this word translation. Translation is a code word at NIH. And it's been around now for about 5 years, and it's an attempt, a top-down attempt, to co-opt the scientists to change the way that science has been done, which is creativity, which is curiosity-driven research, and instead to get scientists to try to gear their research towards solving health problems, which is what NIH is all about. The mandate, the government gives scientists money in order to help, from NIH at least, to help solve cure diseases. And most of the money does not go for that. There is some clinical budget, but the basic science budget basically has been an investment into basic science, which is going to produce, in the distant future, 10, 20 years, discoveries that will be the bedrock for future translational. But now they're trying to speed up the process. They're trying to get the scientists actually, they call it from bench to bedside, to actually deliver within a few years, 5 years of the grant cycle, something that's going to have a practical impact. And it hasn't, an interesting social phenomenon. I'm not sure how successful it's been. I think it's been more, publicity than actually changing the patterns of how research is done. But In our case, I think this is a real issue. I think that, and we call it, we don't call it translational research. I just really don't like that word. We call it inReach. And there is somebody who's put a lot of thought and effort into it. I'd like to ask Javier to give his experience and how you got into inReach and what you're doing now, and perhaps give us some inspiration.
That was a surprise. Oh, really? That was another surprise. So maybe I can say just a few words about my experience with the Ruby project. I think it's been a wonderful experience for me as a scientist. And so the goal of the project really was to develop entertainment robots. And this was being paid by Sony, which made it possible for us to be able to do research that was not laboratory oriented and was research that was centered on getting a product out as soon as possible. And we had to make the decision, it was very clear to us that if we just engage in the standard scientific practice of bringing children to a laboratory and do hypothesis testing one at a time, there was no way that we were gonna get there. So we had to change our methods. And so we decided to immerse scientists, engineers, and robots into this classroom at the Early Childhood Education Center on a daily basis, and that included actually for the researchers to learn how to change diapers. We were very happy when the Sony engineer was actually accepted to be one of the diaper changers. We were very proud of that. And it was really a wonderful experience, and one of the things we noticed was that it really changed our way of thinking in terms of what are the important things that need to be done that would be useful in the classroom environment. That was one. Another observation was how much we actually learned from the problems that the teachers were facing, and how, you know, important scientific questions were there and that you couldn't find in the journals because they were not part of the of the mode of scientific interest at this point. And the other thing that we also noticed was a mismatch between the version of science that the teachers were being told and science as it really is in practice. For example, it felt more a little bit like an indoctrination of principles, like Piaget says this, therefore teachers shouldn't do this. They shouldn't teach because children have been shown by Piaget that they actually construct their own knowledge and they don't need to be taught. Examples like this. And I felt that may be true or may not be true, but that idea that science is crystallized and is not something fluid was something that really bothered me. And in particular, it bothered me that in many cases it was going against the empirical experience of these teachers. So I felt it was very important to have these two-way interactions. That's where the idea of inReach came. Sorry for being so long.
So I think in Javier's case, he didn't give the whole story because he had an early education child in the center, didn't you? So he already knew a little bit about the center, and so it was a motivating influence to actually get in there and see what's happening. And it's motivated his research. It's an interesting intersection between business, Sony, building entertainment robots for the general public. The first one was Aibo, the pet dog, and then what was the name of the Curio?
I mean, Sony has terminated.
Sony has temporarily terminated. There is a very beautiful story, actually, on the termination of Curio, but I won't go into that. But parts of Curio actually are going into your new digital cameras that actually have expression recognition and that came out of this project.
So tell a story about Spotlight.
The smile detector. So we developed a smile detector. Oh, actually, it was very interesting. Marnie particularly has been leading the work at the laboratory on expression recognition, and consistently, you know, her methods work outperform everything out there. But then, you know, we developed together a smile detector, and we put in this robot, and we brought it to the classroom, and it wasn't working at all. And then that also was very helpful to us to realize that the databases that were being used to train these smile detectors were not complex enough. They didn't have the variability necessary to have a system that worked in actual environments. So because of that, thanks to that, we engaged in collecting a very large data set of expressions in very difficult rendering conditions. And now we have a smile detector that has been put on digital cameras that you can purchase. It turns out also that another company is likely to put a more complex version of facial action recognition in these cameras, so you can actually, in a few years, possibly be able to have cameras that can recognize your facial expressions at very stone level detail. I think the lesson to me on this was how important the fact that we moved outside of the laboratory put us ahead of the curve with respect to other research groups and allow us to develop a product that had practical applications.
So that's really the bottom line here, that the activity that you are engaging in here as part of the center is not just servitude that you're putting in because you've got to be here for this meeting because otherwise you're not going to get money. No, this is what the activities that you're doing here are going to give you an unfair advantage with respect to all of your colleagues, because you're going to have access to a huge pool of talent, experience, and through the formal process that we're developing for actually going into classrooms, doing the in-reach, your research will be enriched. So this is really, I think, what we're trying to do is an experiment in collective research, helping each other. Rather than competing against each other, we're trying to help each other. And that's really a big, I think, question mark, is how well we're going to succeed. Because if we don't, then we're in trouble. And we may not get renewed. And if we're not renewed, then bye-bye. But, you know, it's been fun.
Yeah, that would be great.
Now, there's my father-in-law once told me, said, Terry, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing for money. And we laugh at that, but the fact is that we aren't living in an ivory tower, right? In other words, we don't really do things purely for the intellectual pleasure. Obviously, that's a factor. But if you're starving in the ivory tower, right, you ultimately need to get some reward to keep you going. And this came back to me just recently because of some of the early work that was done by Tony Bell. I mentioned independent component analysis. Well, we have a startup company that was started by a few of the postdocs in my lab. And the idea was to apply ICA to some real practical problems. And we were very ambitious when we first started out. We were going to use ICA to solve biomedical signal processing problems. We're going to use ICA to solve telecommunications problems. Well, at the very end, the company focused, because the reality of the workplace is that if you're competing against entrenched technology, and you've got to be better than they are, and you can't work on everything because you're small, you have to focus. And so we ended up building the world's best headset for doing noise cancellation. So ICA takes multiple microphones and tries to separate out the signals from the different sources. And so if you're using, for example, a headset, you know, one of these things you put in your ear and there's a little boom coming off, the booms are getting very short, right? What that means is that they're going to pick up the background signal. That's going to be as loud or louder than your voice. And if you're talking to somebody through your headset in a very noisy environment, such as a restaurant or a sporting event, they won't hear you because they'll be drowned out because they can't use their binaural localization as they could, for example, in a real cocktail party. Well, SoftMax, the name of the company, put two microphones at the end of the boom. It turns out that these headsets now have DSPs in them, digital signal processors. downloaded the software. It works really well, really well. So SoftMax, about last month, was bought by Qualcomm. So that's one of the exit strategies. If you're starting a company, either you go public doing an IPO or you get bought up by a bigger shark. We got bought up by one of the biggest sharks in San Diego, so we're...
So are you rich?
Well, I am wealthier than I was, yes, but I can't say I'm actually rich. But the point, though, is that having a goal...
Nobody will give you free
heads. That's right. I can separate out the different sources for you. That's right. No, the reason I'm bringing this up is that and this is an issue which is a very difficult one, which has to do with, well, what if you do come up with a better gidget for education? I mean, just suppose that it actually happened in your lab. And it was demonstrably, you know, when the students coming in, you're able to speed up the learning or something. Then what? What do you do? What are you going to do? Are you going to go out to a school and say, hey, you should adopt this? Well, if you try doing that, you'll discover very quickly that it's very difficult to get anybody to listen to you, and nobody's going to adopt it, right? And so that's the question of how do you actually deliver? How, if we actually are successful as a center, how do we get it into the classroom, right? Now, there's a model that everybody uses because it's been successful in the biomedical area, which is if you come up with a better drug, you go through the FDA, and you have it approved, and that takes about $100 million plus. And then you make a lot of money on it if you're successful. However, it turns out that there are only a few blockbusters. You have thousands and thousands of people coming up with ideas for drugs, and only a few of them actually get through. So therefore, there's a winnowing process there. But it's not clear that that's the right model, business model, for what we're doing. So I'd like Paula to discuss briefly her thoughts about this, because she's actually gone through this process and she has more experience about this than anyone else that I know, at least in this room. And Bill, yeah. So which one do you want to...
Go ahead.
I'll start. Bill can continue. Well, I think that if in 1994, when the four of us, Bill, Mike Merznick, Steve Miller, and I started doing these studies, we had any idea where we'd be sitting now, we may have reconsidered. Because it changed our life as we knew it, for sure. Bill and Steve probably even more, because they ended up going full-time as scientists with a company rather than with a university where they'd been their whole career. But these are very serious issues, and there's a real cognitive dissonance, I think, in science and in this whole situation, which is important for all of us to understand if we really have a goal eventually delivering. And that is, every grant I ever wrote, I've gone back and looked at them, always began with the big goal of improving assessment and treatment for children with developmental language and reading disorders. And I was funded, I was very fortunate in a time and place, I guess, I was funded consistently for about 25 years doing that kind of research. Then we did this study that was extremely successful, showing that we could use basic animal research learning studies in neuroplasticity to actually drive underlying deficits in the brains of children with language disorders and reading disorders and improve their language and reading quite dramatically in a short period of time. And we were left with the decision, first of all, what happened was we were just inundated with phone calls after we had our research published in Science, because it was picked up by the public press, and we literally were inundated with phone calls from teachers and parents and grandparents and everybody. Could you send me the CD? Okay. Well, there wasn't a CD to send. This was a very complex laboratory study, so we had to make some really significant decisions and quickly. And I love what your father or your stepfather said to you. If it's worth your father-in-law. Okay. A lot of people say, oh, it's not about the money. Well, you know, my feeling is that a lot of these children have been, what I've always said, delegated to felt and glue. their whole life. That is, you know, someone's going to put something together for them so they can play with felt and glue and maybe improve their speech and language, you know. So if it's Thanksgiving, we're going to have turkeys, you know, like little felt and glue things that we play with while we're working on grammar. And if it's Halloween, you'll have a different set. And if it's Valentine's, you have some little hearts. That's a little over-exaggeration. But when it came to really thinking about putting something out there that was going to require an awful lot to develop it, the question is, are you going to do it through a business and through the regular capitalist system, or are we going to continue down the road of small business grants through, you know, NIH or a not-for-profit or whatever? I mean, these were real decisions. And, you know, from a scientific perspective, you know, we have a whole philosophy and a whole culture and a whole ethics of what we think one should do. And from a reality perspective, if you really have an intention to get out there, and as Terry says, you know, what are we going to do, go to the school next door and, you know, provide it for them? Or do you really have a bigger dream and a bigger vision? So we ended up deciding we would go the business route. And we developed a company in 1996, I think, late 95, 96, and got venture capital funding. I mean, kind of like Javier was saying, he got involved with a company that has deep pockets to help us develop a series of programs. And those programs have now been out to more than 1 million children in 42 countries over 10 years. But here's the interesting thing that happened. At that point in time, I have never applied for another grant from a federally funded agency on my own work because of potential perceived conflict of interest, because now there's a company involved and they're making money and this, that, and the other. And there's always this cognitive dissonance. When I give a talk to a science group, I try very hard never to talk about the product, mention the product, whatever. When I talk to another group that might be educators or whatever, that's what they want to hear about. So I really have to be really careful. And so it's a conflict. And I don't think the science has really thought that much about the conflict. Now, an easy thing to do is just, like, put it out to somebody else, and then you're not involved. Like, let the university owns the intellectual property. They go and they maybe give it to Sony or sell it to Sony or license it to whatever. But in our situation, there was no one out there. It's not like this is a drug, and there was no other company that really had a clue about how to do this because we were doing something quite different. So I think Bill should maybe want to talk. But it's been incredibly rewarding, and it's been incredibly complicated. The only other thing I want to say is that what scientists would like to see in terms of evidence that a series of interventions or whatever works is that they would like a, you know, very careful, the gold standard double-blind study carefully done by scientists and their well-trained researchers, research assistants, maybe done in a school, maybe done in your lab, with great controls and whatever. And this is where this whole thing can be terrific. And when you get to schools, the people who are going to make the decision if they're going to really use something in a classroom, that is not the evidence they're interested in. What they need to know is, how does this compare to what the teachers in my school are already doing? Is this going to be a better outcome for my kids or a worse outcome? What are the cost effectiveness of this? How hard is it going to be to implement this? Are my kids going to be better off at the end of doing this versus whatever else I was going to do with them? So it's such a different set of criteria and priorities. And that's what I talk about when I say about we really need to understand much better what the differences are in terms of what it is that the people who are going to really have the effect on whether or not what you've discovered is going to get to the kids that need it versus what it is that scientists might think would be the beautiful study. What a school wants to know is, does it work with my kids? They don't even want to know, does it work with the kids down the block? They want to know, does it work with my kids? And so their idea is, all they really want to see is a pilot in their own school trying something out and seeing if the teachers and the kids and the parents seem to be happier than they were before they put this in place. So it's really interesting, like this constant, you know, shuffling all the time about what constitutes the evidence that really will matter to whether something gets to kids.
Let's see what I can add to that. I would say the other thing that I think Yeah. The other thing that I think is really important, and I think Javier and Terry hit on it, and that is the sooner that you are able to take it out of a laboratory into a practical setting, the kinds of questions that you as scientists will ask will change. They'll be different than anything you've ever thought of because you have to deal with a different set of issues. And some of them are scale, but some of them are political, some of them are social, some of them are really pragmatic issues to get it to actually work in the environment, to have the kind of outcome that you get in the laboratory is going to cause you to think differently about how to apply your science in a practical environment and deal with the realities. So our first study, first two studies done at Rutgers University, we had kids for half a day, 5 days a week, right? Okay, and we got really great results. So now, take that to a school and go to the school and say, okay, for the next 6 weeks, half of the school day, I want your students. And, you know, the teachers and the principals are going to look at you like you're crazy, okay, because you're not going to get it. And we chopped it down to 100 minutes, and that was still a ridiculous amount of time. So all I'm saying is the sooner that you can take your science, put it in a practical form, and have it interact with your target audience of learners, the faster your science is going to progress, and the better your questions will be in the laboratory, I believe.
So,
I know you have a couple more speakers. I wonder if the Preuss and ECEC teachers have anything that they'd like to say or respond to about any of what you've heard so far. I mean, for example, I mean, some of you have actually had experience, I suppose, with Ruby and Ruby's descendants, and how is that working for you, and what's your experience with trying to bring ed tech into your classrooms, or is any of that... is any of this resonating with you?
Come on.
Sorry. Hi, I'm Denise. I work with the infant toddler age group at the Early Childhood Education Center in the Mesa Complex. And I've worked with Ruby and Javier, and I feel it's an excellent resource that the children love. It hits on every developmental stage that the children are working on, just reiterates everything that, like, as caregivers, as teachers, you're trying to implement in the classroom. And I completely agree with bringing the technology into the classroom and using it, evaluating it, assessing it, because that's the only way you're going to get farther. Seeing, you know, what works, what doesn't work, what you could add on, what you could bring. And then that would also help us caregivers to see what we could bring also, you know, on our part, you know, as like media, what kinds of things could we... It's my first time coming to this, you know, conference of technology and seeing how the brain develops and all the, you know, neurons and everything that's coming together. And it's such crucial for the children, you know, and for caregivers to know about that and be aware and see what more we could do on our part to help implement and, you know, and work on that. So I agree. And it's wonderful having them in there. I wish you could all see them.
I'm not convinced yet that it's crucial for you to know about the neurons and the kids, you know, to teach the kids. You know, that does anybody have any evidence yet that it's crucial? I mean, there's Fast for Word, which depends... No. But do you need to know, you know, do you need to know how lights work in order to turn the switch?
I'm on the way. I can only move so fast.
Yeah, not always. But it's better when I'm quiet like this. One of the things I noticed when I was a teacher was that basically there was no metric, and that every single child had a different learning style, and that there were different modalities, different ways of explaining things that worked best on a particular child, and it was a matter of basically recognizing when they were befuddled, when they had an aha experience, and going with that. And so it's more of an expert process. So that actually got me very curious, like, what's up with this kid's brain versus that kid's brain? And it is interesting to actually know and be able to recognize, because it does help you predict a little bit what the next step you might take is given X set of behavior. Oh, that might mean this whole array of things is different, so let's go this path. So I think it could be useful in that set. And on the other hand, in terms of what Bill was talking about and Paula, it's almost an insurmountable problem, because basically I think much of our education system would be very different if we actually took these things into account, because, you know, we line the kids up, we stuff too many in a classroom, you put one teacher there, there's no preparatory state for learning in half of them anyway, let alone letting learning proceed, and then they're, you know, overbooked, tired, stressed out. And so they're, you know, it's a really hard problem, I think, for a teacher to solve, because there is no one way. So I think one thing to think about, too, is the variety of different ways learning might proceed and sort of what underlying principles cause different brains to go in different directions with things, basically.
So I wonder if someone from the Preuss School could chime in here, because this would be a good opportunity for us, because they're one of our partners.
Terry, I'll give this to Juliana. But could I suggest something else after this, by the way? When Rob introduced himself, he talked about doing work that he hoped would translate into educational stuff. So it might be good to go back to you at some point and ask you what you were talking about. And we also... maybe you could speak again as well about it. But here you are, Juliana.
Oh, thanks. I get really nervous. I'm a teacher and I talk in front of like 30 people and I'm okay with that. And now I'm like sweating. So, yeah. Good. Along with what you were saying, I think it definitely does help with knowing how the different minds work. Because for instance, you know, I'm a very visual learner. And I'm a very tactile learner. But because I know that, I know how to study better. And I know how to remember what I'm studying. And I know how to teach myself. And I think not only the teacher's understanding that there's different types of brains, but the student's understanding that there's different types of brains. And I think bringing that into the classroom would be very helpful, because I think a lot of kids sometimes hit barriers. And it's not because they don't get it. It's because it's not in their like language, if that makes sense. But and I think as an educator, it's really important to see when that student, like you said, gets the aha moment and you're like, okay, now we can do it that way again next time. So that you can really see how to steer and differentiate the instruction so that you're not just hitting those, you know, high learners or those low learners, that you're hitting everything in between, and that they understand. Yeah, like kind of what I said before, that they're not just not getting it, because I think a lot of times kids just shut off. But if they know, you know, actually, I need you to draw a picture, because that's how I am. If someone just talks to me, I'm like, no. Nah. But then, you know, by him writing it up there, that was helping me so much. So, you know, but having that visual cue and having that talking through, so. Here, do you want to say anything?
Rob, I'll come over there. And then, April, you had your hand up earlier, didn't you? Should I come back to you? Oh, you got one.
Okay, so I just wanted to say a little bit. So I'm trained as a very traditional cognitive psychologist studying artificial category learning. That's what I did for my PhD. So, you know, so we did different square sizes of yeah, in different colors and gave people different categorization splits for this. And that was my background. And eventually I got interested in how people learn scientific principles associated with complex systems, like the diffusion processes that people have talked about, or just positive and negative feedback systems. And so because I teach a course in complex systems at the freshman level at college, I really became interested in why these principles were so hard for our students to learn. And you know, after checking with the local IRB to see whether it was okay to teach concepts that I actually wanted the subjects to learn, it turns out that that was okay, and they let us do those experiments. And so there was a number of experiments that we did looking at how certain decisions that one would make about how to design computer simulations to teach these principles would allow these principles to be learned, and basic design ideas of if you have a simulation where you're teaching a certain principle that uses an ant scenario, do you want the ants to look like ants or do you want them to look like dots? Under what circumstance for training and for transfer? How much user control do you want? How much feedback do you want? Do you want the students to be able to explore these simulations at their own devices or solving certain worksheets? You know, very basic questions, but to us they were also interesting theoretically because they related to the basic question of the connection between abstraction and perceptual grounding. We firmly believed in perceptual grounding, like a lot of people in the sensory motor network here and the PEN network do, but we also saw some pitfalls to a panacea approach to perceptual grounding, to making everything as concrete as they possibly could be. And since then, we've actually been going into the middle schools. And so we have a number of projects with local middle schools trying to teach these principles that we thought might be too complex for the middle schools, but when taught using some cognitive science principles, they seem to work.
I wanted to speak to the importance of something that that Terry mentioned and also Paula, and that is accessing the people who actually make decisions in the educational system. And I really think that the beginning, well, I guess they've been doing this for a while, but targeting superintendents and principals, you can have something that's been out in the educational community for years, that people have known about in the science community for years, like when's the best time to begin to introduce a second language. I mean, we've known that for what, 20 years, 25 years?
What time do teenagers like to get up in the morning?
That's right, those sorts of things. And yet, I know that in some progressive schools now, they're beginning to introduce languages in kindergarten and in first grade. But in most schools, they started in junior high. So how do you get these insights about how children learn and how effective things are at a particular, maybe not a critical period, but a sensitive period, a time when it's most optimal to present this type of information to a child. How do you get that to filter down into the system so the teacher can actually implement it and can see, can get some gratification from how well that works with a subgroup of kids? And so I really think one of the really critical things to do are just the sorts of things that you've been doing, and maybe even on an even wider scale. I know Paul and I talked, I don't know, how many years ago was that, to people of state educational directors or whatever, and I don't know, we didn't see about how you could take what's being learned about the brain and translate it into the educational system, and they listened and they nodded their heads and they went away, and nothing ever came of that. But I think being involved in the way that we're all suggesting, that actually we can sit down and we can talk to one another and say, hey, you know, this really works and this is the reason that it works. And I think that's a really good place to try to make that a bigger part of what we're doing.
But, because we're all Americans, we don't need to learn a second language.
Go to your room, Dad.
No.
I'm going to speak as a parent briefly about two negative experiences I had about new technologies in the classroom. So the first is fast forward. And I have a kid who still has a reading disability, and I really wanted fast forward because when he did his IEP, it was clearly evident that processing speed was his problem. And I spoke to everybody in my district, and they all looked at me as if I was mad, and I ended up taking my kid to a private school. One suggestion for a solution to that is you get the parents on board, because if I'd had 7 or 8 parents with me hammering on the principal's door, she probably would have buckled, but I'm not a convincing advocate for anything. The second experience was earlier at another town in North County, San Diego, with one of those 10 out of 10 schools, they introduced new math, and the poor parents who work in the classroom all the time are rolling their eyes. And new math was that there are different kind of brains, and all brains are not alike. And when you have perceptive teachers, they know that anyway. And when you have teachers who aren't paying enough attention to what the kids are understanding and not understanding, then telling them that didn't really help. So the new math was that when you add, you know, 298 to 517, you can add 300 and subtract 2, as opposed to doing it. And the way that they implemented for these poor first graders is that they made them do every single addition problem 4 ways. The mothers were crying, and the kids were bored. And there was no, you know, it was a beautiful idea when they introduced it to us. I was very excited. It was like, yeah, that's how adults add. But, correct. I don't know about the solution to that.
Yeah, I wanted to address some of April's comments about getting superintendents and principals to adopt new things and to change what they do. And I think it's important to understand what their pressures are and probably eventually use political avenues to change what their pressures are. And perhaps that might be feedback that could go to NSF, because they would be in a better position to do that than this group. But it seems to me that that's really ultimately going to be the way to get the practices in there, including getting something like, maybe not as bureaucratic as the FDA, but some kind of mechanism to make sure that new educational practices actually have been thoroughly evaluated, tested, and shown to be effective before they're adopted.
So Paula has some interesting insights here.
Yeah, so those are all really terrific comments. There is actually something, most scientists don't know about it, but it's called the What Works Clearinghouse. And it is part of No Child Left Behind, and it is a mandate from the federal government that exactly what Marnie is asking for, and that is that that anyone who wants to introduce a new product or even have a product or a program or a curriculum or whatever you want to call these things, evaluated, you can send it to the What Works Clearinghouse. So it's a start. The problem there is that there's always problems with something that's new. It's better than having nothing, and I think it is terrific to support. And maybe Brenda would like to speak to this, because she has a lot of experience in this area as well. But what they've tried to do is adopt a scientifically rigorous approach, which most scientists would agree to, which is a randomized, double-blind, intent-to-treat approach, and apply that to any number of studies that people might want to submit. I'm going to be a little off base here, but let me just say one other thing that has been a real big issue. Scientists do studies in their way. Usually, if we're lucky, we have, you know, 12, 15, 50 children, maybe a few more in our studies with great controls and this, that, and the other. Educators laugh at that. If it doesn't have 10,000 kids in it or 1,000 kids or something like that, it's meaningless. Really, it is to them. But educators, believe me, they have equally rigorous processes. As you said, superintendents particularly are under enormous pressure not to make mistakes. They're very risk averse. And they have internal research going on all the time. And much of it is very, very good research for what it is they need to find out. They do not publish it. Okay, so that's another issue. So where does that data go? It goes to the individual school to make their own decisions, and there's no mechanism. So that's another really interesting issue. They don't publish. Doesn't mean it's not good data. Doesn't mean it's not essential data. But the What Works Clearinghouse is quite interesting. But they've adopted what a scientist would think of as a good study, and the educators are all numb over it. I mean, they're crazed over it to some extent, and I just saw an incredibly interesting and scathing critique of the What Works Clearinghouse, because, yes, you can have a double-blind study, you know, that has 50 kids and outcomes that are basically teaching to the test, and that can get the highest review by the What Works Clearinghouse because it was done with a double-blind intent to treat, kind of placebo-controlled group.
So, this is a very important insight having to do with the nature of education, the educational system that we have. And it's also very closely related to a similar experience I had with architects recently. So there's a group now in San Diego called, Academy of Neuroscience and Architecture. And the idea is that by understanding how the brain works, we're going to be able to build better buildings and better enclosures and lights. And you know, there's a lot of things. And one of the things they took on was hospitals. It turns out hospitals are one of the worst possible places to be from the point of getting well, because they're just dismal places, right? I mean, they wake you up in the middle of the night. It's just horrible. It's invasive. It's very noisy. There are people running around. You know, I mean, so can we use some basic knowledge? In fact, just common sense that would tell you that hospitals... It turns out the design of hospitals goes back to some report that was commissioned by the government after World War II, and since then, all hospitals have been based on that. It's just a bad design. But when I started talking to the architects, what I came to understand was that architecture is a guild, and every single office has its own secret sauces that they then try to sell to the clients. And it's not published. They don't do controlled, even, you know, real experiments. They just do things that they think work because they got an award. And often things that get architectural awards are things that the people who are actually in the building don't really like very much. So we're facing a problem. I think education is a little bit like architecture in that regard. That it's really based on a lot of common wisdom and local knowledge, and it's not done in a way that you would, as a scientist, accept as being the best practice or even a proof. And it may be that the principles the brain really is using are ones that we just don't really fully appreciate. And I'd like Javier to say something about this, because Javier has actually been ahead of the game for most of us, and I think he has probably the strongest opinion on this respect, stronger than mine, but nonetheless, I'd like to hear his view.
No, I actually don't have much to add to what Andrea said. Andrea is the one that actually made me be born again scientist or whatever. One time she told me, "We may not have a mind, but we sure have a brain," and I really thought that that made a very important point, which is that we have to be extremely careful about the use of concepts being imposed on how the brain works, because we may be very wrong. I'm not a neuroscientist. I came to it from a more of a computational point of view, and I felt that many of the concepts that came from psychology were actually not very useful to me when building robots. And that made me believe, well, maybe also they are not that very useful to the brain. And maybe we want to think of the brain in different ways. And I think having this different perspective is important.
Yeah, well, if you had as many colleagues as Andrea has in the cognitive science department who are clearly wrong, maybe you'd, you know. The cameras are still off. I wanted to bring up maybe a different tack altogether right now. It seems to me that one of the things that we've been saying here is that, and anybody who's a parent with more than one kid knows, is the individual differences are often a lot stronger than we might believe if we just looked at standard psychology developmental text. You know, it's the standard thing. Before I had kids, I had 6 theories of bringing up children. Now I have 6 kids and no theories. I think that one of the so what does that mean operationally to us? And I think one of the interesting things that we might do here is, I'm sure Paula might agree, I don't know, that there are two kinds of kids, the kids that fast forward works for and the kids that fast forward doesn't work for. And you'd like to know in advance, you'd like to be able to screen the kids. What does which population of kids does this actually work for? Because I think a lot of the issues that, you know, this works, this doesn't work, gee, it works this time, it doesn't work that time, have to do with individual differences. And as Juliana was saying, you know, you really want to tune your teaching to the kid's learning style. And I think that our interventions should be tuned to the kid's brain style, whatever that might be.
So part of the problem, though, Gary, is that, yes, there are individual differences between kids, but there are the teachers can't handle that because they have to. They're dealing with a classroom of diverse kids, but they have to teach to the median, right? And so you would ideally like to have tutors, one-on-one tutors, but that's very labor-intensive.
But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about ed tech, right? Where fast forward is not an individual person, it's a program.
And that's where technology can really be useful because it can, based on what is understood about neuroplasticity in terms of general principles. And one of the most important aspects of that is easy to hard learning, individually adapted, trial by trial. And that's just one of the aspects, but that can be built into a computer in a way that it just can't be. I mean, the very best teachers understand that, and yet they have 30 kids to deal with, and they can't be at the right timing for each child in terms of what that child's brain really needs. So this is where technology can be really useful. It's absolutely true that there are children who benefit and those who don't benefit. And in small samples, you have the luck of the draw in terms of how many of which you might have gotten. The other issue, which is really critical for this kind of discussion, which hasn't come up enough yet, is the issue of scalability and implementation fidelity once it gets out of your lab. And that is a really difficult issue because so many of the really good ideas require really training a trainer to a very high level and then maintaining that level when they're in the real world classroom, which is extremely difficult. And so it limits ultimately the reach or the scalability of what you can do. And that hardly ever comes into a discussion when you're kind of trying to prioritize which research, even like internally here, we have various projects that sound really interesting and that have a lot of outreach potential. But the question about scalability has not been addressed. Let's say in our wildest dreams, one, two, or three of these were really great, then what? How do we get it? I mean, we might be able to get it to Preuss. We might be able to get it to a local school where we continue to have control. But how in the world do you scale it to a level that it can really reach and be transformative at that level? So Bill Jenkins has developed, I think, one of the most incredibly complex, smart algorithms for actually reading the performance of children all over the world and giving instantaneous feedback directly to the teacher or the monitor. And we have to think about these kinds of issues in addition to our good ideas of how are we going to ever maintain control once it gets out of our classroom. Mouse click by mouse click. Well, one of my big hopes and dreams would be that somehow this group could interact with that data set and do something really good with it. What we have done with those data, I think, is pretty exciting, and that is we've used our own data to improve the products. I have a hard time even calling products as a scientist, but the business requires us to call them products because that's what they are. They're for sale. So to improve the programs, products, whatever. So Bill should talk about this because they had almost over a year process of actually improving our programs based on the actual data that we had from all these kids.
Yeah. Can I say?
It's okay.
Okay. One of the things we talked about early on, and I'm hoping Bill will respond to this too, is your data is sequential data, mouse click by mouse click, but you don't have timestamps on it, which seems really important.
Actually, we do have timestamps on every trial.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah.
For the clicks.
Well, we know what's presented, we know the student's response, and for every response, we have a timestamp. for every kid.
So you know when they clicked with relative to when the stimulus was presented?
Yeah, in a millisecond time domain.
Okay, great. Because that Paula didn't know that. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, no.
It has not been used. It's an incredible thing.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the couple things. Individuality of the students. The more information you have about the demographics of the student, and if you have lots of data that you've collected and you analyze, essentially do individual item analysis and segregate the item analysis by the kind of kid, you can learn an awful lot about the learning curves and the differences between different groups of kids. In this last couple years, we've done that to some extent. Looking at kids who are classified as special ed kids, kids who are classified as general ed kids, and kids who are English as a second language. And looking at the learning differences going through the same products, and you see similarities in certain areas, and you see stark differences in other areas. And that's allowed us to create variation in the revisions of the product. Now, it would be really nice is if you could do it in a way that sets a completely different learning path based on what you know about the more information you have. So I have, you know, dreams of this thing being even more individualized as time goes on. The other thing that's pretty cool, because you have this information and you can describe the normal learning trajectories of a given age or demographic category. So you can describe a good outcome. What does a good outcome look like on every exercise that you have a kid go through, every learning set that you have a student go through? And you can actually devise you can devise what I call automated intelligent agents, is the way I refer to them, that are really looking at patterns of learning based on a particular demographic category. You spot it and you say, is it in the right trajectory or is it not? If it's not in the right trajectory, then what you can do is you can pop up what we call intervention flags, which then tell the teacher, so the teacher doesn't have to be a data expert to mine the data by looking at all the graphs and reports. A little flag comes up and says, Mary Smith is having trouble in this exercise, and this is a specific kind of problem she's having, and here are the two things that you could do to help her. Now, that we already have that implemented on a large scale for all of our products, and it could get a lot better with more data analysis. The other thing it could do, ultimately, is change the experience that the learner has by intervening very specifically in a very detailed way on an individual basis. But we're not there with that aspect of it yet. So anyways, this data loop, this data feedback, and data collection is extremely critical, I think, for the progression and understanding of how to make these things, how to optimize the learning environment for individual kids, and to know how these learning tools are being used in the specific environments. Because most things that are available to our educators today, it goes to the principal, it goes to the classroom, they're told what they're supposed to do with it, the door closes to the classroom, and nobody, unless the principal comes in and watches the teacher on a regular basis to see how they're doing, you don't know how it's being applied. So you may have a wonderful intervention for math or whatever, but if it's not used in an appropriate way, you have no way of knowing, you know, do I have a lousy intervention or is it a lousy implementation?
No, this is interesting. So what you ought to do then is, first of all, see if after the intervention red flag, in fact, there is any change in the learning curve. And if there's not, the principal should get the flag.
Actually, the flags are used by superintendents to have in places where we have really great outcomes and really great implementations. The superintendents meet monthly with the principals to talk about how the implementation is going, and they use that information and other information about the product use. So it's been really critical from an enterprise management perspective to improve the quality or fidelity of the implementation and the fidelity of the outcomes.
Well, we've run out of time. I think this ended on exactly the right note, that why is this the right time for studying time? The reason is that computers have now gotten to the point where they are pervasive enough and powerful enough so that if you do have a really good idea and something that really is going to work, there is a way now to scale it up. There's a lot of social problems involved, and there's a lot of political problems. But you know, those are problems that can be solved. The point, though, is that we're at this point where we can really make a difference. So thanks to everybody for making the breakout session a breakout session.